Right now, we're nowhere close to that. Right now, our government and our culture is marginalizing and even persecuting Christians. So I'd argue this is not the time for the fours and the fives to sharply separate over what the ideal political theology would be. Right now, the orcs aren't just at the gates. They're on the city council. They're all over. They're in power. And we should be able to band together as a small minority as we are and say, can we fight together against transgender mutilation, against LGBT ideology, against abortion, against wokeness, against socialism? Can we do that?
Welcome to Christ Overall, a podcast dedicated to helping the church see Christ as Lord and everything else under his feet. My name is David Schrock, and today, Steve Wellam and I are going to talk to Andy Nasselli about his long-form essay that catalogs the relationship between religion and government into seven categories. Andrew David Nasselli is no stranger to Christ Overall. So far this year, his article on women and head coverings has had more hits than any other article we've published. But besides being an expert on head coverings, Andy has written a commentary on 1 Corinthians, a short little book on Romans. He has recently helped edit a big book called The Dictionary of the New Testament Use of the Old Testament. And most recently, his book on predestination has just come out. He's written a ton of other books and articles as well, too many to list right now. Without a doubt, Andy is one of the most thoughtful biblical and systematic theologians today. And in recent years, he has turned his attention to studying political theology. While not professing to be an expert, he is an accomplished scholar, and he has served the church well with this introduction to various approaches to religion and government. And that is what we're going to talk about today. So Andy, welcome to Christ Overall.
It's my pleasure.
Glad you're here, brother. And Steve, I hear some of the leaf blowing in the background there in Louisville, Kentucky, but glad to have you with us, brother.
Good to be with here and discussing Andy's wonderful article, helping us think through these important issues.
Yeah, so we've kind of moved from the month of October thinking about Christian nationalisms and all the conversations we had there. For those who are listening to this podcast, if you didn't listen to those, I certainly encourage you to go back and do that. But we're beginning to move towards a biblical nationhood and beginning to think through some analysis of what we heard last month and to begin to process what are ways in which we should think about political theology. And so, Andy, you've written a really helpful, extensive, carefully researched piece here on different perspectives on religion and government. We're going to get into that. But maybe just a little personal background. Where did you begin kind of studying and thinking about the issues of political theology?
Yeah, some people have told me kind of stay in your lane, and they think my lanes are either exegeting the Bible, so like writing a commentary on Romans or 1 Corinthians or Greek exegesis or biblical theology, or systematic theology, which is what I teach mainly now. So like writing a book on predestination or something like that. And anything beyond that is like, you don't know what you're talking about. You should just shut up and, do what you can do. And my view of just knowledge is it's all integrated, and you can't just siphon things off like that. And I've always had a very, very strong interest in politics as well as religion. And that interest has grown in the last several years, and particularly in the last year for various reasons in my own church and school context. So I just, in addition to, decades of thinking about it, I dedicated most of the summer to doing research and writing on this issue. So this article is a fruit of some of that.
Yeah. I think you mentioned just in the context of it, I mean, you spent some time with the guys with American Reformer and just even some of that. Maybe just tell us a little bit about what that was.
Yeah, I didn't know them much personally prior to this summer, but my friend Joe Rigney told me about an internship they had. It's a fellowship, and I applied and got in, and I got to interact with guys who are really well-versed in political philosophy. So this is not what my focus has been in the past. So there are guys that were in the fellowship with me, thinking in particular of Ben Crenshaw, who would repeatedly quote Aristotle or Plato and cite book and chapter the way that I would in the conversation talking about Paul. And I was just blown away how well he knew his primary sources and American early founding sources as well. So it's really helpful for me to interact with guys who share a similar theology, but have different areas of expertise in history and political philosophy.
Yeah, that's helpful. And certainly appreciate the work that you've done. It certainly comes out in just the footnotes of all the things that you've done here. And Steve, as you've read Andy's piece, how did he do bringing these things together? Some have said, you know, kind of stay in your lane here, but what would you say to how he's put some of these things together?
Well, you can't just stay in your lane, right? So Andy's exactly right. You know, especially with Christian theology, right? Christian theology covers all of life. And of course, you have to spend time learning the field and becoming aware of it and everything else. But if we simply leave the field to experts, that's usually where we get into problems. We've got all kinds of experts running things, and they're doing a disastrous job. So we need to bring Christian thought to bear. And so Andy's piece is, you know, very, very helpful. I mean, as he said in it, it's a very difficult task to provide a taxonomy, to put people in it without saying, oh, but. Yet we have to start somewhere. And I think the way that he has done so is just a good place to start and to think through different positions and then where we would fit and how we would, you know, bring a Christian view to bear on all these areas.
Yeah, it's ironic to me that there seems to be this push for more interdisciplinary studies. And yet when you begin to do that, you know, people then cry out, no, you can't do that. You got to stay where you are. And yet I think we'd all say that the knowledge is integrated. There's a transcendent truth that God has given to us, revealed in the Word of God, and it should have impact on all parts of life. And so, Andy, I'm appreciative of what you've done here and really been helpful.
Yeah, some people might think that the motive for studying politics right now would be a worldly motive. Like the world's talking about this all the time, so that's why we're doing it. And that could be someone's motive at this time, but as best I know my heart, my motive is that I love Christ's church and I love what's true, and I'm trying to be helpful to my fellow pastors and to my school and my students and my church members, and trying to help add clarity to something that's really complicated and confusing right now. So that's my heart.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And even what I kicked up on Twitter today, or now X, right, just this work as we published it, to say this is a labor of love for the church.
Yeah.
Right. The church needs to think through these things, and knowing you and knowing your heart, I think that comes out. And I think that's an important thing to say. Well, Brother, let's kind of dig into some of the things that you've written here. And you have not addressed this as church and state, but rather you have used the language of religion and government. I wonder if you would, one, define those two terms for us and then explain why those terms are better for this conversation.
Yeah. So the term religion I define as an organized system of beliefs that answers ultimate questions and commends certain actions or behaviors based on the answers to those questions. So as a Christian, I think that the religious institution that God has ordained at this time period is the church. It's Christ's church. And then politics is the science and art of governing men. And the reason I chose to go with religion and government is I'm trying to be broader than just the Christian church debates. If I'm proposing a taxonomy, I want to think beyond that to what do non-Christians think, what do other religious views think, and try to see how it all fits on a spectrum. And then I think government's more helpful than the word state, because government can be broader than state. So people hear the word state, they think modern nation state, but I'm trying to do this taxonomy that includes past centuries, way back, millennia back, that's broad enough to encompass them.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful starting point. You make that clear as you kind of begin and even have a little helpful chart thinking about historical settings, the use of the term religion and the use of the term government. And so It helps us to do that. And you give us seven different perspectives or seven different views along the way. And I appreciate both, you know, you have historical examples, you have modern examples, and it helps to kind of flesh out and to make concrete these different abstract ideas that by the time you get done, it's not so abstract. And so it'd probably be helpful for us to just walk through these things, these seven different views. Probably the first two I'll mention, but we don't need to get into them too much unless you want to. But the first one that you bring out is just the secular suppression, that the secular government suppresses religion, that it's all government and is all nations, all state, whatever it is, no religion. So Marxism would be a chief example of that. And then contrasting that with the second perspective that you have of religious separation, religion must radically separate from the government. And so the Anabaptists or even some modern Mennonites, like even the kind of perspective of Stanley Hauerwas and Greg Boyd, would have that sort of perspective. Is there anything that would be helpful to kind of note in those two positions? Because I think most of the debates today are probably closer to your positions of 3 through 6.
That's correct. And it's just helpful when I think of a taxonomy, I'm thinking of the metaphor of a spectrum where I have laid out before me a line and there are gradations along it. So on the far left would be views that separate religion from government, and on the far right would be views that combine them. And then in the middle, that's a looser combination. And as you will see as you walk through this, views 1 and 2 and 6 and 7 are the outliers. Mm-hmm. And it's really 3, 4, and 5 that is most of the debate in our world.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, let me just pop in there. I mean, if we're keeping it to the debate over Christian nationalism, I think you're exactly right. I do think we have to acknowledge that view one is almost the prevailing view of our culture today. So that we have to be aware of that, right? So we have these in-house debates about how we're going to influence the society. We've just come through an election and we're seeing that our society is basically operating without any Christian influence. And so that view one has to be taken seriously in the sense of where are we in our present society? The secular suppression, I don't want to quibble with Andy's presentation here, because I understand he's defining religion in terms of organized religion, but I'd want to make a case that the secular suppression, the secularism is organized religion. It's just of a different sort. It has, as many have said, its sacrament is abortion. It has its offices. It has everything else, right? So, I mean, Andy, you don't deny that, but I mean, just in the sense of for sake of argumentation, the secular push is religious at heart, and it is organized, and it is pushing away. I mean, in our particular culture, it is trying to drive the church out. So we have to be aware of that. That's the world we live in. And you eventually come back to how Christians need to not divide on these matters because we have larger issues that we're facing in the society. I mean, we really are facing a major, major change in our society.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful, Steve, because, you know, the examples of Marxism, whether that's in the Soviet Union or China or North Korea, make mention of that. But what is taking place in our country is moving in that direction. So certainly secular progressivism that is there and seeing it in religious terms. I know that's something that David Koises does in his book, Political Visions and Illusions, where he uses kind of the, you know, creation, fall, redemption, new creation kind of schema to help map out how these different political visions have a religious root to them. And so that's helpful for us to see those things, because that's in many ways what we're combating when we're not having intramural debates. Those are the things that are being pressed upon us in the culture around us.
Yeah, and I know Andy doesn't disagree with that, and the way he set it out here is fine. But I mean, in many ways, once we admit that, of course, then we're going to basically reject view two, where this idea that you can have this separation and there's no influence. And I mean, as many, many people say, there is no naked public square, is there? Some religious view is going to be promoted. And what we're seeing today is the secularism and the postmodern, you know, kind of secularism that's being pushed, but it's religious at heart. That's why much of the Christian nationalism debate has arisen, I think, to say, how do we respond to this? How do we influence the society? Where are we going as a culture and so on?
Yeah, and one of the things they're doing is responding too to this third point that Andy has made, right? So the third view, right, religious neutrality, the government must be religiously neutral. And you have some of this kind of a classical liberalism, but even also mentioning John Rawls. Andy, would you kind of just unpack that a little bit of what classical liberalism is and how John Rawls is someone who has impacted kind of the modern discussion about this neutrality in the public square?
Yeah, and I want to be careful not to imply that all classical liberals would be view three here. Mm-hmm. Many of them would be view four as well.
Yeah.
So the way I highlight the distinction of view three is the idea of religious neutrality. So not all classical liberals would say this is where I'm at. So they're saying basically you have government, you have particular religions, they should both coexist, but the religion should not influence the government at all. And in a sense, it should be religiously neutral. And in America, in the recent past, there's been some form of this with a civil religion. So a lot of people who would say, yeah, I'm a classical liberal over the last several decades would be thinking of that, of there's like a semi-Protestant civil religion. And I say semi-Protestant, just think after 9/11, when there was this prayer that includes people from all kinds of religions. It wasn't just Protestant religions. That was our civil religion at the time, which I would say is idolatrous. It was wrong. It's syncretistic. But in many people's minds, that's okay, because it's kind of a flattened, Jesus is not Lord in that religion. There's no dominion. There's no, we're under him. It's just it makes us feel good when we need, when we're in a crisis type thinking. And the idea is it's always wrong for religious people to publicly argue based on their particular religion. At most, you can do natural law. So that's the idea I have for view three.
Yeah, and I think it's probably helpful, and we saw this last month as we talked with Mark David Hall and a few others, that this was not the position that was at the founding of America.
Correct.
It's something that has come about, and so even the language of a wall of separation between church and state was really kind of redefined, thinking about the Everson versus the Board of Education 1947. You have a change in the way that is being perceived. And of course, then John Rawls is a philosopher, a political philosopher, who's impacting that today. And his name gets thrown out a lot. Andy, what do we need to know about John Rawls, and how has he impacted the modern conversation here?
Yeah, just so you know, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on John Rawls.
Sure.
So I've talked to guys who are experts, and they immediately jump into, well, there's the early John Rawls and the later John Rawls. and they're, you know, here's what he believed then, here's what he's later. For my purposes, all I want to point out is that he is a figure who represents the view that the relation between government and religion is such that the religion should be neutral in that relationship. That's all I want to emphasize here. There's so much more you could talk about with Rawls, but in my taxonomy, that's the only thing I'm highlighting.
Okay, that's helpful.
Yeah, the taxonomy is important, and to put the position out there, I just have the cynical sense that this is only possible in theory. In the actual practice, it's never actually the case, right? So even John Rawls, who says we want a religiously neutral, he already assumes all kind of religious viewpoints. So that's just the larger argument. But in theory, we could say here's a position along the taxonomy. This is actually not even achievable in history.
Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. Well, let's get into point four, because this really comes closer to some of the things that we talked about last month, and this idea of religious influence that the government should not promote only one particular religion, yet religion may influence the government within limited parameters. So maybe define that, describe that a bit more. And maybe, you know, one of the things you talk about is that in each of these different views, there are degrees within them. And this seems to be one where some of those degrees are fleshed out the most. So maybe help us to think about the different degrees we might find in this view.
Yeah. So here's how I would describe this view, which I would say is the predominant view in our circles, mm-hmm. especially among Baptists.
Yeah.
And we are Baptists. Mm-hmm. So this view says that the government and the church, I'm going to use the word church here instead of religion, because this is specifically about the Christian church. The government and the church are separate in the sense that they have distinct jurisdictions that God has authorized. So those authorizations include the government can wield the sword and the church can exercise the keys. So those are distinct jurisdictions. And the government shouldn't exclusively promote a particular religion. So it would be wrong, according to this view, for the government to say we are a Christian government, and this is who we are. We're a Christian nation. So the government further shouldn't restrict the spread of false religious belief systems. So sometimes there's a debate. If someone wants to build a mosque in the town square, this view would say it should be allowed to be built. We can't refuse that. This is religious freedom, and religious liberty requires that. So religion, though, can influence a government. The difference between this one and the previous view is that in view three, religion is supposed to be neutral, and this one is not naive like that. This one's saying there's no neutrality. There's a religious battleground here. That's actually one of the phrases Jonathan Lehman often uses.
Yeah,
it's
Jonathan,
a religious battleground.
Yeah.
This view, someone would say an individual United States senator could argue for a political position based on his Christianity, that'd be fine. But the government may not adopt that position on the basis of Christianity. So that the public square can't be religiously neutral. It's a battleground. But when you argue for your position, you can do it based on your Christianity, but the government itself can't do that. It has to be based on natural law, universal principles of some sort. So the emphasis of this view for the church is that the mission is very specific and clear. Make disciples. That's it. Make disciples. And then individual Christians should significantly influence the government. That's good. Influence is good, but not institutionalize. The government should not institutionalize Christianity. Influence, not institutionalize. And this is most Baptists. Isaac Backus is a one often cited here. Modern guys include Wayne Grudem, Jonathan Lehman, John Piper, Andrew Walker, and Scott Annual. You interviewed both those guys. Mm-hmm. Actually, Lehman as well, three of them. David Van Drunen, Robert George. All of these would say religion should influence the government, but not institutionalize it.
Yeah, or to use the language that Timon Klein says, coercive conditions conducive to conversion, right? Is what he gets to for point five, view five.
Right, that's
it's
different.
Not doing that, right?
Correct.
It's not doing that.
Correct.
Well, it's all important to see as well. I mean, Andy has said this is a Baptist view. The last two names he mentioned also, it spans the larger Christian world too. David Van Drunen obviously is a Presbyterian, and Robert George is a Catholic. So it's interesting to see. So that view has quite a wide spectrum. And you're right. I mean, it predominantly in our circles is given by Baptists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Andy, would we find any person who identifies themselves as a Christian nationalist here, or would all that would all be in view five at that point?
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a minute, but the View 5 folks don't all call themselves Christian nationalists.
Understood.
But yeah, correct. But this position, definitely not Christian nationalists. Though that's according to how they label themselves. The media, of course, would call them all Christian nationalists.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. So when we talked to Dr. Moeller, one of the things he talked about was the acknowledgement of the first table of the law. And I think we had some offline conversation about, was he talking about that in historical sense, the founding of America, or is that actually something that we should be encouraging today? I took him in to say that that's something we should still encourage today, that there would be an acknowledgement of the first table of the law. Would that be moving more towards the fifth view,
would
that still be?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, so I actually went back and tried to read as many theologians as I could from the 15, 16, 1700s. Mm-hmm. Very, very routine for the theologians in that time period to say that all the Ten Commandments apply to us in our civil government setting now. Mm-hmm. No one that I was seeing other than the more recent Baptists were saying it's only the first table that's set aside and you're only under the second table. It was a whole thing. And that even some Baptists, I mentioned John Gill as one of the Baptists who would be an exception to the majority of Baptists. Yeah.
So you think in the view four, then, if we think of it in terms of first and second table, that the Christian influence would come solely on the second table, but not the first. And that would be a distinction from view four to view five.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of discussions I've had with my friend Jonathan Lehman, who would say, you can't enforce as a civil government commandments 1-4. Like, how are you going to enforce that without having blasphemy laws? And that idea is repugnant. So it's the second table, especially like murder and such, that's enforceable.
Yeah, which then would fit with the natural law arguments as well.
Except for coveting as well.
Then also, I don't think it's consistent in even adultery laws and such, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me just kind of press into this Baptist question here. This is something that I think Joe Rigney had put on Twitter, X, a couple of days ago, thinking about the fact that did the Baptist Project, which goes back 400 years or so, again, you know, some landmarkers will say it goes all the way back, the Trail of Blood and all the rest, but if the Baptist Project began 400 years ago, it began in the context of Christendom. And I'm wondering, is the Baptist Project, you know, where there's this division between church and state, as you're describing here, and it's influencing, did that require Christendom? Right? In other words, are there first principles in Baptist theology that would lead to something that would be able to produce what came about? And maybe there is, but just historically speaking, Baptists came into existence in the period of Christendom. I'm just wondering if you've given thought to that. You said you went back and looked at that. John Gill is arguing for some of those things. Just thoughts about that.
Well, first thought is theologians today disagree on what is a Baptist. So for some people, to be a Baptist is essentially you're a credo Baptist, meaning you don't baptize babies. You baptize professing believers who credibly profess to follow Christ. And that's what makes you a Baptist or not. For others, there's a more robust definition that includes a whole slew, sometimes six or eight distinctives that you unpack, one of them being a particular view on church and state. So some today are saying, you know, that a certain political theology is incompatible with Baptist theology. That's usually the people who hold that broader view. And the reason is it's a historical reason is that most Baptist theologians have held view four, not view five. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
And your point is, well, that view arose out of a situation. If you could rewind the clock and have Baptists prominent prior to Christendom, could they produce a Christendom? And I don't know. I think someone in view four might say, well, if there's massive revival and massive influence on a government and on a culture, then yes. But that wouldn't be the goal. That wouldn't be a goal. That'd be a byproduct. That's a good one. But that's not the focus in any way.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve and I were talking about this the other day of just thinking about Baptist theology, which we all are, and not on that thin level, but rather on a more robust understanding of how the covenants work out in Scripture and what the new covenant means, and that the church is, yes, baptizing believers, but because it's a regenerate community that is tied to what Christ has accomplished in the new covenant. But it's as though Baptists are most comfortable, it seems, to be kind of living out their convictions in the loser's bracket. And if there was a revival where there really was a majority of Christians, and there have been that at times, is there a political theology that allows for that? And that seems to be something that could be developed further among Baptists.
Yeah, that's a reflection I have later in the article, which is, it seems the majority of at least evangelical Christians in America that I'm familiar with feel more comfortable being the persecuted minority. Mm-hmm. And they haven't thought through, well, what if we were the majority and we had more power politically, then what?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that would be bad. We'd be doing something wrong if that were to happen. Mm-hmm. And this our history of theologians in the last several centuries, many of them thought this through. Today, I don't think we've thought it through as much.
Yeah. We'll talk a bit more about that. Maybe just to transition to the fifth view then.
Yeah.
So this is Christian government and religion overlap. You've spoken about the magisterial reformers. That's a key historical piece that is there. Introduce us to them and the arguments that they are making and how that applies today.
Yeah. And I'd say this view is Christian government. And I'm saying Christian because this view is peculiar to Protestant Christianity. So in this view, imagine, and I have this in the article, a Venn diagram with government and religion, and there's an overlap, which shows that there are distinct jurisdictions, but the jurisdictions can overlap. And it's that overlap that's distinct, I think, in significant ways from view four. So it's saying that the overlap between government and church is such that they should work together under God's ultimate authority. So Christians in this view, at least many of them would say, the church's mission is to make disciples of all nations. And so a lot of people say there's a distinction between views four and five, such that view four, the mission of the church is make disciples. View five, it's something broader, like disciple the nations. And that may be the case for some. I don't think that's critical here. I think someone could be very like-minded with our Nine Marks brothers on what is the mission of the church. I'm there. That the mission of the church is you make disciples. That's the mission. But further to this view, here's where it distinguishes it from view four, is it says that individual Christians should not just influence the government. The government may institutionalize Christianity to some degree. And that can look different in different governments, but it might mean that you put God, the triune God, specifically in the Constitution and acknowledge him as the authority who is the one who created government and to whom we give an account. So in this view, the government should identify as a Christian government in the sense that all of its laws and customs that it's promoting should derive from God's ultimate authority. So I'm thinking like in Daniel, Book of Daniel, the government authorities acknowledge that they're accountable to God for how they rule. I think this view would say it's fitting for the government to exhort citizens to fear the living God. So this view would say that the government should pursue justice by promoting the natural law. And it would say, this is the classic Reform view, that the Ten Commandments summarize the natural law. And we have to take into account covenantal realities and how you talk about, for example, the Sabbath laws. And it'd say that the government should with the church and society help create cultural conditions conducive for conversion and for the common good. And I'm tweaking that. I think Timon said coercive conditions. I'd rather say cultural conditions rather than coercive. Cultural conditions conducive for conversion and for the common good. So the government should promote and to some degree enforce a just social order based on a right understanding of God and man. For example, what would that look like in our situation? It'd mean that the government would promote marriage and the family, and it would demote no-fault divorce and adultery and homosexuality and transgenderism and pornography. So I teach ethics, and this last week we had a class on sex slavery and pornography, and the guys had read a bunch of stuff. One of them was a chapter by Wayne Grudem, and he has a paragraph in there saying, I don't think there should be any laws against pornography usage, maybe against pornography production, but not usage. And maybe I'm crazy, but I think if it's wicked and harmful and doesn't just harm you, it harms everybody you come into interact with, it harms society. Yeah, I think it would be just for the government in some ways to penalize it. Maybe it's with a fine or something like that. But even if it's hard to enforce, just having that law on the book teaches. It teaches. Like when you have a law against marijuana, that does something, even though you can't enforce it across the board. When you remove the law, that also does something, and it also teaches. So this view would say that the government can't force citizens to follow Christianity. So some characterize this view as, you know, you've got the sword and it's like, convert or die. No, the weapon of the church is not a physical sword. It's the word and water and bread and wine. That's it. So this is magisterial reformers like Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Knox, Richard Hooker, Althusius, and Reformed Scholastics, Church of England, Baptist John Gill, American Puritans like John Winthrop, William Bradford, John Cotton Mather, Jonathan Edwards. And really, it's a basic approach in various colonies and states at the time of our country's founding.
Yeah, it really seems that this is the historical soil from which the American founding began. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting that many who have the fourth view want to return to things from the founding, but you wouldn't get the founding apart from actually taking the scriptures and applying them even into the structures of government that is there, and certainly informing the law that is taking place there as well. And this is something that I learned just reading Yoram Hazani's book, Conservatism, the impact that the Hebrew scriptures had on the English law tradition. And I just think that's important to be able to see how those things are taking place. And it does seem like there are ways in which this idea of coercion is almost like an Islamic approach to things, right? To say that the converting people are forcing conversion or forcing obedience to Christ is using the sword to do that instead of producing, if you used your language, of cultural conditions that would be conducive for conversion, which is still fundamentally different than saying that it's going to convert people to be Christians and just produce a nominal Christianity.
Yeah, no, when you look at these positions 4 and 5, I mean, they're, if I were to draw this, I mean, you have 5 as a Venn diagram, this overlap. I think 4 is also that as well.
It could be.
But because the influence that's being brought on the government is, you know, religious influence. So obviously the government is adopting, even if you were to say second table of the law, you know, our laws against homosexuality, laws against, you know, polygamy, laws, you know, things like that, murder and so on. There's certainly a strong moral Christian influence that is overlapping. Yet it seems your distinction of the establishment of Christianity versus the non-establishment really sort of distinguishes these two views. And we've seen in our discussions with Andrew Walker and Scott Aniel and others like that to Jonathan Lehman is that that's what they're really saying. No, there can be no establishment. There can be no Christian name placed upon the government versus those who say, yes, we can call it Christian and we can establish that even in that establishment, there's then difference of opinion as to what actually would be established, right? So obviously second table, but you know, how much does one do first table? How much does the older theonomy argument in terms of the civil laws of Israel then come over to our nation versus general equity laws? And so then you would have in-house debates on, you know, what that government would look like as a Christian government.
Mm-hmm. So this is certainly where the conversation lies between the 4s and the 5s here. Andy, do you see, is it a dotted line in between? Is there kind of, you know, a gradation between the two where some might be like 4.5 or 4.7? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you see that kind of thing taking place as well?
Yeah, I just listened to the interview you did with Dr. Mueller, mm-hmm. and I need to re-listen or read the transcript to try to make sense of some of what he said, because I thought he would be squarely in view four, mm-hmm. but he said some things in the interview that sounded like view five.
Yeah.
So there are people like that, I think, that would be overlapping these views. Yeah.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Well, and a lot also would tie to, I mean, what you raised before, you know, the in terms of history, right? So say you do have a situation where, you know, the gospel, the Lord has benefited, brought many conversions. There's been like a great awakening, evangelical revival spilled over into society. And we have a majority of people voting as Christians, right? I mean, and then what do you do? I mean, obviously, they're going to establish laws of influence, but I mean, it's going to look more Christian because you have a majority of people who want Christian, you know, want laws that reflect God's demand and moral norms and, you know, things like that. So you know, it all depends on the historic circumstances, right? Then you go to another country where we're a minority. We then have our theory in terms of influencing China, influencing Iran, influencing these countries. And so there's where we have to, you know, also look at the present historical situation we're in and what circumstances we face, as well as then the theory of what would it look like in any kind of given situation as well.
Yeah, a good test case is imagine if there was an unexplored, uninhabited place in this world that you could take, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 people and you're the leader. What do you do?
Right.
How do you set it up? You're going to do a monarchy? You're going to do some kind of democratic republic? If so, how? Will there be a religious test for office? Will you allow blasphemy laws? Will there be Sunday blue laws? All these things. And you realize, okay, maybe the Puritans who came here weren't crazy. Maybe they knew what they were doing.
Well, that thought experiment is a historical fact in some ways because that's what they did. I mean, very unique in world history to see that they were able to come to a place and to establish a civilization, church and state. And what they did was to have a very much an encultured Christianity in the laws that they're making. And this is something I appreciated from Joe Boot. I was just talking about that there is something to pursue of a Christian culture, which is still different than cultural Christianity. And so I think we can affirm that without denying or distorting the mission of the church to go and to make disciples. Well, let's keep walking through these things, and then we can talk about some of the ways that you kind of assess this at the end. So view six is religion over government. Religion governs the government and directs the government to enforce religion. Here we get to talk a little bit about Rusas J. Rushdoony, but help us to understand what this is and maybe how Rushdoony has not necessarily fit into this group, but people have said that he has.
Yeah, so this is basically the two swords view of medieval Roman Catholicism, and I don't know of a perfect modern example that parallels that. So, and you know that view where for the medieval Roman Catholics, the two swords both belong to the Pope, and the Pope directly wields the spiritual sword and indirectly wields the temporal sword by commanding the governmental authorities. So that's why people call it the doctrine of the two swords. Mm-hmm. So the sword of religion trumps the sword of government. So I just imagine the Pope might say to a magistrate, you need to punish that dude. He's a heretic. And the magistrate says, okay, the Pope's telling me that he's a heretic, so we got to punish him. That's how this works.
Yeah. Steve, why have people assigned Rushdoony to something like this? And what's a better way to understand Rushdoony?
Well, it's because they never read Rushdoony. I mean, you have a lot of people that, you know, say all kinds of things about theonomy.
Yep.
And whether it's Greg Bonson, Rushdoony, just in our PhD colloquium here at the seminary, we interviewed Ken Gentry on his book on post-mill, and he was a student of Greg Bonson and so on. And you listen to them actually talk, and you find the positions are quite different than what people perceive them to be, right? So we have this problem of people reading secondary literature, and they never read the people themselves and know what they say. So I do think what Andy has said here with his reference to Andrew Sandlin, Andrew Sandlin's interpretation of Rush Dooney. And I've read a lot of Rush Dooney on culture and the nature of education and psychology and so on, which he's been very, very helpful as a cultural critic and apologist. So I do think Sandlin is correct. And I think he would say that it's only through the preaching of the gospel, it's only with the change of, a majority of people being able to vote. So I think he probably is in that category of number five. Now, where the issue becomes is with the older theonomy is the wrestling with what's the law of God and what comes over, particularly from the Mosaic Covenant or from Israel. And, historically, theonomy has been known for saying the law is divided up into the three parts, moral, civil, and ceremonial. The ceremonial is now fulfilled, but there would be civil, moral, and civil laws that would come over. But even then, when we talked with Ken Gentry, who's adopting that view, saying, well, you have to be very careful what you bring over from the civil law, right? So, Rush Dooney's Institutes of Biblical Law carefully went through that, but then brought modification for the present day state and so on. So I do think he fits best in terms of number five. And I think the two swords, the Roman Catholic, what we had in history in the Western world with Christendom and so on, is probably the best example of this. Or you can go to non-Christian examples. Islam is tricky here, isn't it? Because they wed government and religion together, yet religion is telling the government what to do and the government is religious, right? So six and seven sort of blend with Islam. That would be, and there would be other cultures as well, I'm sure, with around the world where religion is affecting the dominating, in terms of the governing and so on.
Yeah, on Islam, I talked to a handful of brothers who've been full-time missionaries in Muslim contexts in different countries. And I got all kinds of perspectives here on it should be V6, not seven. It should be not six, but it should be seven. It's more complicated than this. And so I the more I dove into it, I realized it's probably more V7. In some instances, it might be V6, but I couldn't think of a concrete, clear example right now of an Islamic country that's V6. They all fit V7 for what I'm seeing.
Well, and one name that you haven't put here that I'd be curious to know what Stephen Wolfe would say, right? As he talks about that government is to not only for temporal, but also heavenly ends, not earthly, but heavenly ends as well, could be something closer to view six, maybe certainly view five. I'd be curious to know what he would have to say about that.
Yeah, I asked him. I didn't hear back. So I'm not sure. My guess is he'd want to be more in view five.
Maybe he'll hear this and he can respond and let us know. Well, then number seven, just to kind of round out the taxonomy, government over religion, the government governs and enforces religion. Certainly Islamic nations today would fall under that category. Maybe there's some differences that are there, but that seems to be the fusion of those two things together, which would not be something that we would find in Christian circles.
Yeah. And what I was hearing from my friends who minister to Muslims in their countries is that my very taxonomy is foreign in their minds. To them, the government is a religion. It's a political religion. They're so integrated to divide them in the way I've divided them in this taxonomy. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's one thing.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to realize that when you go back to view one, the secular progressives who will label all Christians who want to walk out their Christianity into the public square will label us, theocratic fascists or whatever they want to call us, right? Theocrats. Like they often think of it in terms that would be better fitting with Islam, not with Christianity, right? There is something fundamentally different at that point. And that's because we believe that the gospel goes forward with the preaching of the word of God. The sword of the spirit is the word of God, which is fundamentally different than the things we're even seeing on the ground today with Hamas that is trying to win, the world through bloodshed instead of the shed blood of our Savior, Jesus Christ. So I think there's a fundamental difference.
Isn't it been interesting to watch the reactions to Mike Johnson, our new Speaker of the House? And people are saying he's the scariest thing happening right now. It's this MAGA Christian nationalism. And he's like the most vanilla Christian that I've seen around for a while. And he's just saying stuff we've all believed for hundreds of years. And he's like this extremist, dangerous dude.
Now, if we follow, Andy, that religion is organized religion, then of course seven fits with Islam and so on. If we say organized religion, it can be defined, more broadly in the sense, I think one and seven ultimately start merging, which is the irony, right? So that you have
the horseshoe effect. Yeah.
You have in this secularism that's really religious, it forcing itself, right? So you have, you know, six, I think Andy mentioned one, six, and seven are totalitarian, but that's exactly what we're seeing in our society. So where Christian influence disappears, we actually have the rise of totalitarianism. When Christianity, so like a Mike Johnson is there, we actually preserve people's freedoms. We preserve freedom of speech because we do not believe that people are converted by the sword or by coercion or force, but they're by the preaching of the gospel and regeneration and so on. So that's the irony, isn't it? Is that we really have sort of now one flips around to six and seven, even though they're quite different because religion is like Islam governing things, but secularism is also religious. And that's, I've always wondered myself why it is that you can have such the so-called postmodern secularists can so identify with and be willing to support Hamas and Muslim extremists and so on. And my hunch is that even though they're quite different in the sense of one's postmodern and secular and the other one is religious, is they're all totalitarian.
Right. So if you think of my spectrum as a line, 1 to 7, take the end of the line and wrap them around and make it a circle, and 1 and 7 have more in common with each other.
Exactly right. Yeah. And it's interesting, people on the West who are adopting sort of one and shoving it on society seem to then have allies who are seven, which you think, how on earth are these people allies with one another? And I think that's the reason why.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other part of that is that there is no God in their system. Mm-hmm. Right, there is no fear of God in either one of those, which then would chasten some of their aims on the earth.
Well, and one, ultimately, the government state or so becomes God.
Correct.
And then in seven, of course, they have their God that then drives the state.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Andy, you begin to work towards just some reflections here. We have seven views and seven reflections, and somewhere here you have 7 points along the way. So 777 is there. So even though you have said it's an imperfect taxonomy, we're getting somewhere, right? So hey, you say just to begin that this is more descriptive than an evaluation. I think that's helpful for you. I mean, as you've studied through these things, where have you begun to kind of line up? What's been, if you were to teach, here's what we should do and move from description, where would you go? What would you say?
So I get to this in the reflections. I am happy to serve with colleagues on my faculty and as with fellow elders who are threes, fours, and fives. I think we can get along and actually work together. Yeah. I don't think at this moment that we need to be fracturing over this.
That's good.
I would lean more towards the five. I'm not ready to write a book defending it. I haven't thought it through deeply enough. Mm-hmm. And I'd want to give many more years to thinking about it before I were to do that. And I don't plan to do that. But I don't think that if I land in five that, oh no, I need to separate from the fours. Not at all. They're my brothers. I have high respect for them, very high regard. I'd rather us team up and talk about it in an adult friendly way and not build walls between each other right now.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And it's good just to see historically that Mr. Baptist himself, John Gill, was in the five category. Right, and you have so right. many other Baptists who are there as well. So it's not as though that if you're thinking more along the lines that there should be some identification of the state or some cultural institutional that moves you out of being a Baptist. There still could be something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because four and five is maybe three. And you mentioned three colleagues in that. I mean, that view of religious neutrality is very difficult to maintain in reality. So really, it seems to me that if we're honest, I mean, we're really dealing with four and five. And of course, influence should be a given. And then the question is okay, if God is gracious and sees the effects of the gospel spill over into a society, which we have seen in the last 2,000 years, right, in terms of Western society and the rise of present-day Europe and so on, and the influence of the gospel and the Reformation and so on, right, then we would have to still wrestle with it. It's okay, we're having influence, but how would we then establish government. Andy mentioned that in terms of the island scenario. Dave, you mentioned it in terms of, in some sense, our founding had that kind of experiment. And there's where I still think we would see some legitimate conversation between us. So I, as a Baptist and particular view of the covenants and so on, I could move to position five if we had a majority of people in society and say, we're affirming Christianity, but of course my view would say we can't then coerce conversion, that I would still want to argue for a jurisdiction, a sphere for the government within a proper church-government distinction that is tied to the covenants. And some of our Presbyterian friends and covenant theologians would probably have a little slightly different way of thinking what would a government look like, what it would enforce. So you then have differences there, and we'd still have some interesting debates that you'd have to take place as to what actually is the sphere of the government and what is its limitations and what its jurisdiction is, even if you were to say the government is acknowledging that we're holding to Christian values.
Yeah, I agree with what you just said. You mentioned that view three seems outside the pale of working with. Here's what I was thinking. I got feedback on this article from a bunch of people, and many of them are experts in political theology. One of them is a guy named Greg Forster, who knows way more about this than I do. And he calls himself a classical liberal. And he told me that in my taxonomy, view three to him sounded like bad liberalism and view four sounded like good liberalism. And it's a lot more complicated than that. And he thinks it's impossible to simultaneously want the government to be religiously neutral in some sense, and also to desire that religion should influence the government in some sense. So, and when I say three, fours, and fives can work together, I'm thinking of that overlap right there.
Yeah, and then when I was thinking of three, I mean, I don't disagree with you on that. It's just, if we take what your taxonomy is giving us in the sense that it's possible to have religious neutrality,
I don't think
that's possible, right? In actual reality, everyone has religious views. It may not be organized religion, but so there's my presuppositional and worldview and theology coming to bear, is that no one is neutral, right? So that's just simply the observation, even though people with that view we could certainly work with, but how you would actually flesh it out would be the difficulty.
Andy, one of the things you mentioned is that trying to systematize the various views of political theology is challenging, but it shouldn't prevent us from trying. If somebody is listening to this and they've listened to some things last month, and like, I've never read a book on political theology, it does seem like something I need to grow in to understand. Where would you point them as kind of an introduction to some of these things?
I'm not sure. I'm a systematics guy, like yeah. You are both. You're both systematic yeah. brothers. We're so used to studying a topic and we find a resource that says, here are the X number of views, mm-hmm. here are illustrations of them. I looked and looked and looked for something like that in political theology and found nothing close to this article. So that's why I wrote this, was I was hoping someone else had written this. Yeah. So I don't know where to say, here's the best survey of the whole thing. I had to go a lot of places.
Okay. Well, in your footnotes, you mentioned a couple books, so I'll throw them out there, and you can kind of say this would be a good place to begin okay. after looking to this article. So we'll start here, but thinking about David Innes's
yeah, that's book. Excellent.
Yeah. What would somebody get if they read that?
So I told you that I talk to people who know way more than I do. He's mm-hmm. one of them. Yeah. So he's taught this for decades. He knows it inside out. And he didn't tell me, but my guess is he'd be like a 4.7, if not a 5. So he's very sympathetic to the 5 if he's not a 5. And he's read the sources. So he's well versed in Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and the Protestant reformers, et cetera. And he knows it inside out, and he knows the modern scene. And in his, it's a book with PNR. I forget the title, but
in that Christ book, in the Kingdoms of Men.
Yeah, that's it.
Just looked it up. Yep.
It's a great survey. Yeah.
Great. What about David Koicis's book on visions and illusions?
Yeah, so he goes through a bunch of ideologies and just helps us understand what they mean, why they're significant, how to distinguish them. So I found that very illuminating. I don't know much about him personally. It seemed like a helpful heuristic, but I don't know enough about him to say, yeah, green light on everything he's saying.
Steve, anything else from you that would just be a good entry point on some of these things?
You know, I think Andy's put a finger on something, is that there is, I mean, there's, you have good books Innes and others who are surveying things and other books that are introducing you to political thought, but to really integrate well Christian thought, you know, exegesis to systematic theology to, you know, worldview formation to political application is that we're weak in this area, right? We've depended upon a lot of people in the past. We've inherited a whole heritage and more work needs to be done, especially, I think, from some Baptist convictions, even though people have written on that. But we live in a new world, right? I mean, I do think that Joe Rigney's comment of how Baptist theology arose within Christendom, right? I mean, that is not exactly what we have now. And so we have to sort of learn from the past, but do things for the present. So there are those surveys in the footnotes of Andy's article. You've got a number of books. There's some Four Views book and so on. What we're not seeing, in my view, is a real theological analysis that then has proper application to these issues, right? So we have discussion of political thought, but how is it integrated in terms of a systematic theology and a Christian worldview?
Yeah, and one other area that makes this such a complex reality is the history of it, right? There's just so much history that is involved. And so in the American context, I mean, just even some of the founding documents, I think, would be important to be able to go back and read. A number of years ago, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, but on the Bethlehem Baptist Church website years ago, thinking late 90s, there was a list of books, or maybe it was the Desiring God website, a list of books that were there. And one of the books that was listed was the Federalist Papers on that, right? So even just going back and reading some of the historical pieces, I think would be necessary to understand that. And I've been helped by just listening to and reading some of the works by R.J. Rushdooney. I mean, he's brilliant with some of his historical analysis on the founding, and that's just been a helpful resource for me.
Well, and one of the challenges we're facing, right, is you're having to do a couple of things at the same time. You're having to think in terms of the theory, and mm-hmm. then, okay, you know, how would we then think rightly about these matters, biblically, theologically, politically? And then we have to deal with the present context that we live in, which is seemingly evaporating around us, right? So what should the church be doing presently, right? How do we preserve our present constitutional structures that are very, very helpful, wise in terms of how they were laid out, but we're losing the balance of powers, right? The executive branch has taken way much power, more power than the founders would ever have envisioned, and so on. So how do we fight on that front, right, as Christians, because we are citizens of this country and we have the responsibility to vote and to exercise our view. At the same time, we have to think what theoretically should we be doing, right? And so it's a challenging task to, we need people that are laying out the theory, but we also need the practitioners to say we live in a real world and we have to do something.
Yeah, my burden in doing all this is, I'm thinking it's good to go through the hypothetical scenario if most of the citizens in our government in our nation were genuine Christians, what would be the best way to steward that influence? That's worth talking about and discussing. But right now, we're nowhere close to that. Right now, our government and our culture is marginalizing and even persecuting Christians. So I'd argue this is not the time for the fours and the fives to sharply separate over what the ideal political theology would be. Right now, the orcs aren't just at the gates. They're on the city council. They're all over. They're in power. And we should be able to band together as a small minority as we are and say, can we fight together against transgender mutilation, against LGBT ideology, against abortion, against wokeness, against socialism? Can we do that?
Yeah, I think that's really well said, because in reading Stephen Wolfe's book and then talking to him and seeing Brad Green's review of it, it's realizing that he is a historian that's engaging in a political theory that is necessary. But even he said on our podcast that it's like year one or year three of like this beginning process that is thinking about something that may come down the pike, you know, in many, many years or many, many generations. And more practically is, what are we to do today? And I found that, you know, the books like by Rod Dreher of Live Not by Lies and even his Benedict Option, which the title has led people so far astray, but it's rather building communities that are thick with Christianity to be able to withstand the assaults coming from the world. These are things that we need to be able to do today. And whether there were three, four, or five, there are ways that local churches, which is the institution that God established for people to continue to grow up in, this is where we need to be spending our time with helping one another in those ways. And so I do think that that immediacy is something we need to continue to keep our eyes on.
I agree 100%. This is a very, very important point. This is one of the reasons Christ Overall sought to interview people and let them speak for themselves. And as we've done that, we obviously acknowledge differences, but we also have a lot in common as well. And it's a bit frustrating to see in our present context, people just digging in their own sphere, creating their own reputations, screaming at one another on Twitter and so on, instead of saying, look, we've got to work together as the church, those who have common theological commitments and beliefs. And we may disagree on what the ideal looks like, but we're hardly there. We need to be working together and holding hands together and strategizing and planning things as the people of God, because, I mean, we are concerned not only for our neighbor, right? I mean, that's one thing. We're concerned about our children and future, and we also are doing so for God's glory. So that's what we're trying to do. Andy, that's what you're trying to do, to sort of give this spectrum taxonomy, and that's what we're trying to encourage at Christ Overall, to move forward and stop going into our little huddles here and then just shooting lobs and bombs at one another.
Yeah, I'll just be real specific. We have friends, dear friends, who are part of G3 Ministry and others who are part of Moscow and company, and we're dear friends with both of them, both groups. And it's like a knife to the gut when they're sniping back and forth about these matters. It's fine to disagree about political theology in a certain way, but I'd love it if we could just recognize we have so much in common. And it would be really, really good if we could recognize that. And if we'd actually sit down and talk to each other and say, okay, what is our strategy right now? What should we be doing right now? We'd all agree on, we want to have robust, healthy, God-honoring families and churches. Like, that's our focus. And we agree on that. And I think we should focus there.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for having kind of a pure vision of what we're to do constructively. But right now, it is helpful to be reminded that we have the same enemy, right? That there is a devil who is wanting to come to steal, kill, and destroy. And he's doing that through, you know, both local, state, and federal institutions of power that are coming increasingly hard against the church. And we have to learn to find ways to help one another to combat that with the light of the gospel and the wisdom he's given to us in his word. Andy, your third point, this is where we're kind of wrap things up, is there's a lot more to say. And I would say anyone in listening to this conversation needs to go and to read what you have done, to think through that. They can also listen to it. We've had it recorded as well. But anything you want to do to just kind of synthesize or to just kind of bring kind of an exclamation point to the end of our conversation today?
My main burden is that we recognize there's a large spectrum that the people we're most like-minded with, the Christ Overall crowd, is the fours and fives. And I think we should not be trying to distinguish ourselves for whatever reasons right now, more than understand differences, but unite on defeating a common foe, Satan and his demons and his ideologies that are reigning in our culture. I think we should be focusing there.
Yeah, that's well said. Steve, any final words?
Yeah, 100%. This is not the time for division. It's the time for joining together. If we ever get the ideal again, then we can debate. Then we can talk about, how are we going to establish this government? What roles are, what laws are to be enforced? Should we put Sabbath laws on the books or not? And so on. But I mean, we do have much more agreement. We've seen that in our conversations with the whole spectrum of individuals. And it's not a time to keep shooting each other. It's a time to work together.
Yeah, it's well said. Last point that you make in your article, brother, no civil government will be flawless until King Jesus returns. So even so, Lord Jesus, come. That certainly needs to be our prayer. And there's going to be, you know, wars and rumors of wars. There's going to be challenges. There's going to be all sorts of things until he comes. And the good news is that he will, that all things today are under his feet. He's bringing all things under his feet. And one day he will make all things new. And that is certainly our hope. We need to proclaim that loud and in public. Andy, thank you so much, brother, for the time you've given to us and working on this. And I believe we'll get to talk to you again later this month, thinking through some more analysis of what's been said.
Yeah, I can wait for that one.
That'll be great. Well, some of our friends have no quarter November. We have Nacelle November, and we are blessed to have you, brother. Steve, thank you, brother, as well for joining us today.
Yep, great. Great to be with you. This is a very important conversation, and we have to really think of where we go from here, right? And that's really where we're not just talking in theory. We have to work out some practice.
Amen. And friends, thank you for listening to Christ Overall today. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we have a whole month of podcasts on the subject of Christian nationalism. You can go to our website or wherever you listen to podcasts and find conversations with a host of threes, fours, fives, and maybe, just maybe, a six. This month, you can also find articles that explore the impact of Christian nationalism and why we are adopting the language of biblical nationhood instead of Christian nationalism. Later this month, we will have Andy Nacelle back on the podcast to dig deeper into the subject. Until then, you can find a new article dropping almost every day of the week. At the same time, you can go back and see our previous themes at ChristOverall.com. Indeed, the content we publish at Christ Overall is meant to last. And if you are interested in partnering with us to provide the church with evergreen resources that are robustly theological and unashamedly biblical, we would ask you to consider giving to Christ Overall. 2023 has been a great year for our ministry, and we owe that to our Lord and to the friends that He has given to us to help support the ministry. But we are, by God's grace, just getting started, and we would love to know how our ministry has helped you or can serve you in the future. And if you're interested in helping us sustain and enlarge the reach of Christ Overall going into 2024. Indeed, our Sovereign Lord will do all that He pleases, and we delight to rest in His sovereign rule. But knowing that, we want to press ahead and help others to know that He is Lord and everything else is under His feet. Until next time, remember that our Lord is seated in the heavens and all things are truly under His feet. So in all things, let us exalt Christ.